once you've heard that I'm going to do the book of Numbers, I guess that things can only get better from there on. It's not a book we read a lot of, and it's got a pretty boring title to start with, Numbers. It doesn't actually drag you all in, does it? Whoever gave it that title didn't have much imagination. Incidentally, it wasn't given by the inspired writer. It was put there by somebody who put the Bible into shape. They divided the writings of Moses up into these five books, and they gave it that name. And the reason they gave it the name Numbers is because at the very beginning of the book and at the very end of the book, a census was taken. At the beginning of the book, the census was taken to work out how many men were available for the coming conquest of Canaan. So they numbered all the men from 20 years of age and upwards. And at the end of the book, 40 years later, they did another census for the same reason, plus a few other reasons in relation to their settling down in the land. So that's where the name comes from. But that wasn't the name that the Jews gave the book. They gave the book the name In the Wilderness, which makes a bit more sense, because that's what it's all about. It's about the people of God as they were travelling through the wilderness. What we have to do is try and orient ourselves to their situation. I've divided this book into four sections for the purpose of these studies, and what I want to do is to look at some practical guidelines that God gave his people as they were trying to sort themselves out, because they needed some sorting out. If you remember back in the time that they were in Egypt, they hadn't been governing themselves. They had been under foreign domination. The nearest they got to governing themselves was having a few Israelite foremen to look after some of the labour groups. Now they were going to go to a country where they had to govern themselves. And so through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy, God gives them some guidelines how they can sort out things in their own community. Nothing terribly spiritual about a lot of these verses you get. Some of the instruction is simply down to earth, common sense, so that they'll have a few helpful tips telling them what to do. And then their religion was in a shambles in Egypt. In fact, I wonder if they ever had anything much of a religion down there. They're a ragtag mob of people, and they didn't seem to have anything sorted out in the way of sacrifices or priests. But now that they were going to live together as a nation in their own land of Canaan, God gave them some instructions so that he could organize their religion and they could know where they were going. And so we're going to look at God's people and their religious duties, and that's our first study. And then we're going to look at God's people and their leaders. As they sorted out relationships with their leaders, they'd never been free before with their own leaders. And now that they do have their own leaders and their own system of government, their own administration, we find that a few conflicts arise. We should be able to learn something from that. And then we look at Israel and its neighbours. Now in Egypt, while they were slaves of another nation, they didn't have to worry about foreign policy. But now that they're going to have their own nation, they're going to find they have to work out arrangements with their neighbours. And we see a few incidents that give us some guidelines there. And then finally, Israel and their homeland. As they have to settle down in this new place, a few instructions for them, telling them how they can make life worthwhile for themselves. We just want to look at the book in its own setting. They're going to a strange land. They had lived previously in a flat land that was sandy and hot and dry. And now for the first time they were going to live in a land of hills and valleys with an annual rainfall and a set pattern of seasons. Quite different from anything they'd previously experienced. They had never been farmers before. They had all been road diggers and brickies labourers, people like that. And now they were going to be farmers. And again, you find a lot of sensible instructions are given concerning the annual agricultural cycle and how they were to get the best out of the land and at the same time give God his rightful place. Now, a lot of these things are talked about in Leviticus, some of them are talked about in Numbers, and some of them are talked about in Deuteronomy. Our first duty is to understand the book and the writing and the message as it was understood by the people to whom it was first written. And that's my purpose in these studies. They had camped at Mount Sinai for about 12 months while Moses sorted them all out. And it's during these 12 months that the book of Leviticus and the first half of the book of Numbers and the events recorded therein take place. Concerning their religious duties, let me outline for you their central place of worship. They had what is called the tabernacle, and it was a mobile sanctuary. Now, the whole purpose of this tabernacle was that it was a temporary structure. It was very light, very easy to carry, very easy to put together and take apart. It was prefabricated, and they could carry it with them wherever they went. So as they were journeying through the bush, when they'd set up camp, they could set up this mobile sanctuary. It was very simply constructed. A timber framework, a bit like this thing I'm standing behind here, just a timber framework, and then that formed the four sides of a rectangle. And that rectangle was divided into two rooms, the larger front room, which they call the holy place, and inside that there was a table with some bread on it, there was a lamp to give some light, and there was an altar for burning incense, a sign of homage to God. And then there was a curtain that separated this front room from the back room, and the back room was a smaller room called the most holy place. It had just one article of furniture called the covenant box, or the chest, or the ark of the covenant, and that was the symbolic dwelling place of God. The lid of this box was made into a sort of seat as some symbolic throne for God, and it was called the mercy seat, where they acknowledged the symbolic presence of God as existing. Now, only the priests could go into the holy place, and only the high priest could go into the most holy place, and then only once a year on the great day of atonement. Now, this timber frame structure, this rectangle, it was covered with multicoloured cloth draped over the top, just like we drape a tablecloth over a table, and so it covered the whole thing. And then all of that was inside a tent. In other words, a tent was pitched over the whole lot to keep the weather out. So from the outside, all you saw was a tent. But the priests who went inside saw this beautiful sanctuary. Now, that tent was pitched in an open courtyard. I suppose when they set up camp, they got out their machetes or shovels or whatever they had, and they cleared the ground. They dug a trench, and they put in blocks around the base, which they slotted all these framework things into. It was like a giant Lego set. They sort of built the thing up and slotted things in and braced it this way and that so that it wouldn't fall over in the wind. They set that thing up, and then in the courtyard round about, they had two articles of furniture. One was an altar on which all the animal sacrifices were offered, and the other was a big basin, like a bath, called the laver, and the priests washed in this because sacrifice was a fairly messy business, as you can imagine. Now, around the outside of this court was a fence about 2.5 meters high, consisting of cloth draped over posts. The idea was to stop the people in the camp outside gazing in out of idle curiosity, to preserve the holiness and the sacredness of the rituals that went on inside the courtyard. And then around the outside of that tabernacle, you had the 12 tribes of Israel arranged in four sets of three, with one set on each of the four sides of the tabernacle. The Levites were one tribe in Israel, and the Levites provided all the religious officials, all the fellows who looked after the tabernacle, who maintained it, who cleaned it, who swept the yard, who helped in the sacrifices, helped in all the bits and pieces of work that needed doing. They were the Levites, and they were one tribe. And out of that one tribe of Levi, one family was chosen, the family of Aaron, and they were the priests. Now you say, well, how do we get 12 tribes then? If Levi's taken out, we've only got 11 left. But there were actually more than 12 tribes. There were 12, of course, 12 sons of Jacob. But Joseph was given the birthright instead of Reuben, and that meant that Joseph got two tribes. So you don't find a tribe of Joseph. Instead, you find two tribes of Joseph named after his twin sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. That means when we take the tribe of Levi out to look after the religious business, we still have 12 tribes then in the general arrangement of things. Now, when they camped, they set up the camp something similar to this arrangement that I've put on this diagram here. Notice that the Levites camped immediately around the tabernacle, and then all the tribes were further out in this orderly arrangement on the four sides. Now I'm just going to look at those that camped immediately around the tabernacle there. On the eastern side, the thing faced east, you have Moses, who was the leader of the nation, Aaron, the chief priests, and Aaron's sons, who were his assistant priests, and then his sons and his sons and their sons and their sons on generation after generation. All the descendants of Aaron through his sons became the priests in future generations. They were the ones, the priests were the ones who looked after the religious ceremonies, and they camped there. We'll pick up a few verses here and there through these opening eight chapters. We're not going to read them all through. They're fairly boring to read, to be quite honest. So what I'm going to do is just to pick out a few verses here and there to highlight some of these things. For example, if you look at chapter 3, verse 38, it says that those to encamp before the tabernacle on the east, before the tent of meeting towards the shrine, were Moses and Aaron and his sons, and they had charge of the ceremonies of the sanctuary. So that's them. The other three sides were occupied by three groups of Levites. If you can just cast your minds back to Jacob again, remember Jacob had 12 sons. Levi was one of those sons, and Levi in turn had three sons. So the tribe of Levi was divided into three parts. The eldest of these sons was Kohath, and Aaron and Moses and their family were descended from Kohath. The rest of the people of Kohath were called Kohathites, and then the people descended from the other two sons were the Gershonites and the Merarites, Gershon and Merari being the other two sons of Levi. So the Levites were in these three groups. Now if you look at the Kohathites, they were camped on the south side of the tabernacle. And if you look at chapter 3, verse 31, it says in verse 29, the Kohathites camped to the south. And then in verse 31, they had charge over the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, and the vessels of the sanctuary. Meaning this, that the Kohathites, when the caravan moved off, when they shifted camp, these chaps looked after all the furniture. The altar and the table and the lampstand and all these things, they looked after that. That's the Kohathites. The Gershonites, if you move around the next one, in chapter 3, verse 25, notice verse 23, the Gershonites were on the west. And verse 25 tells us that they were in charge of the tabernacle, the tent with its covering, the screen, the hangings, and the screen for the door of the court. In other words, they looked after all the soft furnishings. So when they took down the place, these chaps wrapped up all the soft furnishings and had to look after all of those. If they were torn or they started to fall apart because of wear and tear, it was their job to mend them. So they looked after that part. So the Kohathites looked after all the sacred furniture. The Gershonites looked after all the soft furnishings. And the Merarites, they looked after all the heavy parts of the tabernacle, all the component timber and metal parts. And you find them referred to in chapter 3, verse 36. They camped on the north side in verse 35, and in verse 36, they had charge of the frames, the bars, the pillars, the bases, the accessories, the pillars around the court, all the heavy gear. What happened as the people moved through was this. Each time they had to dismantle the tabernacle, load it up on carts or carry it on poles or something like that, march through the bush a few days, and then they'd stop for another camp and set the whole thing up again. And these fellows had the responsibility of taking it apart, carrying it and putting it together again when they got to their next camping spot. Just notice some of the responsibilities that we have here. The Levites, we are told in chapter 3, have to be kept distinct from the priests. Notice verse 6. Bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest, that they may minister to him. So they are the assistants. They're the rouseabouts. They don't actually offer sacrifices. They don't go into the tabernacle to put blood around various places. They are simply the assistants of Aaron. Verse 7, they perform duties for him, for the priest, and for the whole congregation before the tent of meeting as they minister at the tabernacle. I'm reading from the RSV, incidentally. And they shall have charge of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting. They attend to the duties of the people of Israel as they minister at the tabernacle. And you shall give the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are wholly given to him from among the people of Israel. And you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall attend to their priesthood. But if anyone else comes near, they shall be put to death. Now we have to notice that because it's going to crop up in a story later on. And incidentally, a lot of the stuff that we're doing just here in this first study, you may not find terribly useful in terms of practical Christian living today. But there are other purposes of the Bible besides giving us tips for practical Christian living. Any of the studies that you do at uni, you know that you learn a lot of things that you wonder about their usefulness, but you find you have to know them in order to move on to other more useful things later on. You have to prepare the base from which you can build your other knowledge. And once we get a few of these things in our minds, you find that whole areas of the Bible suddenly make sense, because we know some of the background to other things. So that tells us here that the priests alone could carry out these rites and ceremonies. The Levites helped them, but the Levites were not allowed to go into the tent itself or to look upon the holy furniture or to carry out those blood rituals. Their job was to look after the workmanship and the more practical details regarding the maintenance and transport of the temple. We are told in chapter 4, verse 3, that the Levites had to be 30 years of age when they began work, and they worked until they were 50. In other words, in the prime of manhood. We're going to find a conflict to that later on, where it tells us in chapter 8 that they began when they were 25 years of age, not 30 years of age. So apparently there was a 5-year probationary period or a 5-year training period before they actually began their full-scale ministry. Which again is a point worth hanging on to, that before we can really engage properly in any service God has for us, we do need some period of training and preparation. We just can't walk in cold and expect to do the right thing. And so the Levites had this 5-year training period. When it comes to moving off, when they broke camp and they moved off, what happened was this. The priests went into the tabernacle and they covered all the furniture so that nobody else could see it. They covered it with a soft cloth to prevent scratching and damage. And then over the top of it, they placed animal skin, because this stuff was going to be taken through the open countryside, and if it rained, they wanted to protect it from the rain and from the weather. So it was covered with an animal skin. These pieces of furniture, the table and the lampstand and the altar and the Ark of the Covenant and so on, they had rings at the four corners. There were poles that were slotted through these rings, and then people grabbed these poles, the Levites who carried them grabbed the poles and hoisted them up onto their shoulders, and they marched through the bush carrying the things on poles, one man either end and the article of furniture hanging in the middle. The Kohathites were the ones who carried all that sacred furniture. But before they could carry it, the priests had to go in, wrap it all up and get it ready, so that when the Kohathites went in to get it, they didn't break any of the laws regarding the sanctity of the inner shrine. That's referred to in chapter 4, verse 5. It says, concerning the setting out of the camp, when the camp sets out, Aaron and his sons shall go in and take down the veil of the screen and cover the Ark of the Covenant with it. And then they shall put over it a covering of goatskin. In addition, there was a covering of blue over the top of the Ark, just to make it stand out from all the others, because it was the most sacred piece of furniture and it was the symbol of God's presence, so it was a bit special. But all the other ones, it goes on in verses 7 and 8 to tell us that they were covered with a cloth, and then once again had a covering of animal skin over the top to protect them from the weather. At the end of verse 7, we are told that they put these pieces of furniture on poles, and at the end of verse 8, we are told the same thing. If you go down to verse 15, it says that Aaron and his sons, when they finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary as the camp sets out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these pieces of furniture, but they must not touch them because they're holy. In verse 20 it says they must not even look upon them, and so that's the reason why the priests went in first to cover them. The men of Gershon and Merari, they had different loads to carry, and if you just flip across to chapter 7, verse 7, it says that these other pieces were carried on wagons. Two wagons and four oxen were given to the sons of Gershon, who carried the soft furnishings. Two wagons with two oxen per wagon. But verse 8, we find that there were four wagons and eight oxen given to Merari, because they had to carry the heavier load of all the timber and metal component parts. But verse 9 says that the Kohathites had no wagons or oxen, because they looked after the holy furniture, which they carried on shoulder poles. That's in verse 9. Again, it just emphasizes the different responsibilities. You might say it's some sort of forerunner of the church, where different people have different duties. We're not to get jealous because somebody is looking after more holy things than we are. We all have different jobs to do, and the important thing is that we carry them out as God instructed. Now that's what these people had to do. Each person from each particular division of the tribe had to do the job that was given him to do, and do it properly. And if everybody did their job properly, the whole thing would move smoothly. So it is in the church. If we all did our jobs properly and we discharged our gifts, then things would move along very swimmingly. The essence of the whole business is in chapter 2, verse 17. And that is that God was always to be central in the camp and in their progress through the bush. When they set out, incidentally, if you just look at this diagram again, when they set out to travel, the group on the eastern side went first, led by the senior tribe of that group. Then the Reuben group, those three tribes, went second. And then right in the middle came the Levites, carrying all the Ark of the Covenant and the furniture and the tabernacle and everything else. And then after them came the Ephraim group from the west, those three tribes headed by Ephraim. And then finally, the other three tribes from the north, headed by Dan. So there were tribes at the front, tribes at the back, and the Ark in the middle. So whether they were camped, as you see here on the diagram, with the groups arranged around the perimeter, or whether they were travelling, God was always in their midst. And that seems to be the symbolism of the arrangement. Verse 17, chapter 2, verse 17. Then the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps. As they encamp, so shall they set out, each in position, standard by standard. But always God was in the midst. The meaning, of course, I hope is not lost on us, that that really is the secret of success. That's the essence of the life of God's people. So often I'm afraid God is pushed out around the fringes and he gets the rag ends of our lives. if we can fit him in, well, he might get squeezed in here and there. But so often he's not really at the core of things. He's not really at the center of things. Well, the people of Israel were told, simply by this arrangement, that the whole of their life was to be built around God, and that he was at the center of their lives. A point there, I think, that we can take notice of, and perhaps we can be challenged by it and ask ourselves the questions, is in fact God at the center of our lives, or is he lucky to get a look in every now and again around the edges? Now, that's just a brief run through most of the first 8 chapters. I think I've picked out the main points, and I'm not going to elaborate upon anything more in relation to the tabernacle. But at least I think you've got the general picture of how they set up camp, how they ran the show, and then how they moved off through the journey. Just a few other points in these chapters that aren't in any way related to that matter of the tabernacle. We've finished with that now for the whole series of studies, really. We've got the basis. Just 3 other points. If you look at chapter 5, there's an interesting matter here concerning what we call a trial by ordeal. By a trial by ordeal, I mean a person is suspected of something, and so they have that person do something which is going to determine whether or not he or she is guilty. Now, these were very common in the ancient world. It's rather odd to find it here in the Bible. In fact, it's the only one that I know of that's in the Bible. But it indicates to me again that God took the people where they were. As I read chapter 5, I don't take it as any sort of guide for myself to follow. But then I don't live in the same world that these people lived in. And you see, God always takes us where we are. The remarkable thing is that no matter what our culture or our background, God can still communicate with us and make things work in that setting. Now, these people were surrounded by nations who practiced these things. And on this one occasion, we find that it does occur in the law of Israel. Mind you, it has been purified of any heathen associations, and there's nothing harmful in the whole thing. The way it worked was this. A woman was suspected of adultery. She denied it, but she was under heavy suspicion. So she came along to the central place of worship, that is the tabernacle. The priest wrote down the curse on adultery. He wrote it down on a, let us say, on an empty blackboard or a piece of slate or something. He wrote it down with ink. Then he got pure water and he washed it into a bowl, washed the ink off into a bowl. You get the picture? The curse that he wrote down is now washed off into the bowl, so that the written curse is now floating around with all the water in the bowl. And then he took a pinch of dust from the tabernacle floor and put it in. The tabernacle, God's presence, right? God's presence is there as well. The holiness of God, it's all there mixed up in this bowl. Then the woman took the bowl into her hands, and she swore that she had not committed adultery. She offered sacrifices, she did other things. And then she drank some of the water. If she was suddenly seized with violent pains, she was guilty. But if nothing happened, well, then she was innocent and she could go free. Well, it strikes us as being a bit odd, I suppose. But it was a very dramatic thing when you think of it. That woman drinking into herself the curse of God that was in the ink in the water, plus the holiness and the presence of God symbolized by the dust from the tabernacle floor, it must have been a very sobering action that she took. But notice also that the whole thing was weighted in her favor. I mean, the water was only slightly polluted. It wasn't likely to make her drop dead on the spot. So the chances of her really being struck with some sickness were fairly small, which is in stark contrast to the other trials by ordeal we read about in the ancient world. They were stacked so much against the accused that it had to be a miracle to save him. Drink this cup of cyanide, and if you don't drop dead, then you're innocent. That type of thing. You must confess the person wouldn't approach the trial with much confidence. But one thing that comes through the Israelite law is the fairness of the whole thing. And here you find again that the person is given a good chance. That's chapter 5 for what it's worth. Chapter 6 talks about the Nazarite vow. The word vow has to do with a promise that a person makes. Perhaps a person had been saved by God from some great catastrophe and he vowed to God that he would do something in gratitude to God. Or maybe he just vowed that he would serve God in some particular way. Well, if he wanted to, he could take upon himself the Nazarite vow. And that had with it 3 requirements. Now notice this. He doesn't say, I'd like to be a Nazarite because it would be good fun. And so I'm going to do these 3 things. It's something else that he vows. He vows to do something. And to anchor him to his vow, he then takes upon himself these 3 stipulations. For example, supposing he says to himself, I am going to vow to God that I will pray to him for 1 hour every day for the next 2 months. And just to drive it home to me, I'm going to take upon myself the vow of the Nazarite. Swear by Almighty God that I will do this. And the three things that he was required to do would have kept him up to the mark. So that's the sort of illustration. Incidentally, the word Nazarite has got nothing to do with Nazarene or Nazareth. The person who lived in Nazareth was a Nazarene. This is Nazarite, not Nazarene, and it's not even spelt the same way. It's spelt N-A-Z-I-R-I-T-E, not N-A-Z-A-R. It's from the Hebrew word Nazir, which means something to do with separation. The Nazarite vow was a vow of separation. That is, he was separating himself from his ordinary pursuits of life to devote himself to the thing that he had promised God he would do. And now to keep him up to the mark and to show everybody that he was living under these conditions of his vow, he took these three requirements upon himself. We'll look at them in chapter 6, verse 3. He's not to drink strong drink or eat anything that's likely to produce strong drink. The reason for that would be fairly obvious, I should imagine. Firstly, it's to emphasize to him that he's got to keep himself mentally alert. He doesn't want to be going tipsy or losing control of himself. And also, I suppose, there is some element of denying himself some of the legitimate pursuits of life, the legitimate enjoyments of life. He denies himself those things so that he can better serve God for this period of time. So that's the first one. He doesn't drink anything alcoholic. Secondly, in verse 5, no razor comes upon his head, doesn't cut his hair. Whatever the reason for that is, I'm not quite sure, except that it would make him fairly obvious around the place. Maybe that was the point of it, that everybody would recognize that this chap was the odd man out, and so that was again an open way of demonstrating the fact that he was living under the vow of a Nazarite. And the third one in verse 6 is that he is not to go near any dead body. And the significance of that is fairly plain, because the people of Israel were considered defiled or contaminated if they touched anything dead. So he has to separate himself from those sorts of things. They're the three things. Now, just supposing he accidentally touches a dead body, one of those geckos that crawls around the ceiling, drops onto the table, and he picks it up and throws it out the window, and then realizes afterwards he's done what he shouldn't have done. If he accidentally breaks his vow, then he can offer some sacrifices and get forgiveness. But he has to start all over again. The time that he had already observed his vow is lost, and he starts from scratch again. And I think that's a magnificent picture to us. It's a warning to us, really, because I'm sure that all of us, particularly since we're not under the law of Moses, all of us, I think, tend to take God's grace a bit for granted. We think that God is very light on us, and we excuse ourselves very easily. It was only an accident. I'm sure God understands it's an accident. But the important thing is that all the sacrifices that were given to the people of Israel were only available for accidents. They weren't available for deliberate, willful sins. Now, we think that the deliberate, willful sins are the ones that we really want to cry to God for mercy. We want to cry to God about those things. And we think that the unintentional sins are the most excusable. But the point is that the provisions made in the law were only for the unintentional sins. And that sort of pulls you up with a jolt, because I'm sure that we are just rather too glib at times the way we take God's mercy for granted. Now, there's nothing in this law that we can apply to ourselves according to the letter of the law. But can't you see a principle there? Can't you be reminded of the seriousness with which God views error? And so God was gracious. He forgave him, but he says, you start all over again. We let ourselves off the hook far too easily, I feel. Well, when he's finished the time, he must, of course, have done the thing he promised to do in verse 21. Second half of the verse, in accordance with the vow which he takes, so shall he do. So he must have done the thing he promised to do and also maintained the three requirements of the Nazarite vow. And then he offered sacrifices to release him from his vow. He shaved his head and he was back to normal life again. But notice verse 21, halfway through the verse. His offering to the Lord shall be according to his vow as a Nazarite, apart from what else he can afford. Notice those words, apart from what else he can afford. One of the features we're going to notice in the book of Numbers is what I call the over and above. The over and above. The law of Moses repeatedly gave people the opportunity for the over and above. The law of Moses made certain requirements, and the people had to carry out those requirements, but they were always reminded that when they had carried out those requirements, they had only done their duty. Now in the New Testament, conversation between Jesus and his disciples, we're reminded of the same things. When we have done all these things, we've carried out our service, we've been to church, we've prayed so many times a day, we've read our chapter a day to keep the devil away, or whatever our particular formula is. When we've done all these things, we've served God, we've done things, at the end of it, we've still only done the bare minimum. We've still only done our requirements. We've only done our duty. We are but servants. We can so easily get complacent. We can say we're going to give a tenth to the Lord of our cash or something of that nature, and then settle back and say, well, I've done that. We can make a law for ourselves that we're going to pray at least 35 minutes every day, and then think, well, we've done that. Thank goodness that's over. Now I can go back to watching the telly or what we were doing. We tend to get that sense of satisfaction when we've done what we set out to do. The people of Israel had upon them requirements far greater than we have upon us. And yet there was always the opportunity when they'd done those things to really express their devotion to God in the extras. As Jesus said, you go the extra mile. It's good to go the first mile. But he says, if you go the extra mile, that's really the thing that sorts out the truly devoted to me from the rank and file. And so here the Nazarite, he's done all these things, he's offered his sacrifices, and at the end of the whole thing, there is still the opportunity for the over and above. And that feature, as I say, is going to recur right through the book. In fact, it recurs right through the law of Moses. We move on now to the chapters, we skip over chapters 7 and 8 because they are concerning the offerings that were brought by the leaders of the people when they provided the oxen and the wagons for the transport of the tabernacle. So we skip now to chapter 9, and we have here a note concerning God's guidance. Now you know that there was a cloud that guided them. God guided them through the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And when the cloud remained, well, they remained, and when the cloud moved, they moved. And there are some very instructive verses here, because one of the things that all of us find difficult is to keep pace with God. I think most of us are either a bit too impatient or a bit too lazy. To be right on target is very difficult. We're all extremists in some way or other. We're either screaming and doing things when we should be waiting, or else when we should be doing things, we're sitting back and cooling our heels. This is the tendency of human nature. And this example here reminds us of the need to be sensitive to God in our relationships, to be promptly obedient when we are required to be obedient, and to take our time when we are required to be patient, not to be tempted either way, or not to give in to the temptation either way. I just find these verses so gripping that we'll just read them without comment and see if they grab you too. Chapter 9, verse 17. Whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tent, after that the people of Israel set out. And in the place where the cloud settled down, there the people of Israel encamped. At the command of the Lord the people of Israel set out, and at the command of the Lord they encamped. As long as the cloud rested over the tabernacle, they remained in camp. Even when the cloud continued over the tabernacle many days, the people of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not set out. Sometimes the cloud was a few days over the tabernacle, and according to the command of the Lord, they remained in camp. And then, according to the command of the Lord, they set out. And sometimes the cloud remained from evening until morning, and when the cloud was taken up in the morning, they set out. Or if it continued for a day and a night, when the cloud was taken, they set out. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a longer time that the cloud continued over the tabernacle abiding there, the people of Israel remained in camp and did not set out, but when it was taken up, they did set out. Well, at least by that time they got the message across. Going on to chapter 10, a little bit more concerning guidance. These three chapters are concerning guidance. It's always a hot issue with Christians, particularly young Christians. We're all concerned about knowing God's will and doing God's will. Well, another bit of practical guidance here concerned the blowing of trumpets, and I'm not suggesting again that you listen for the trumpets blowing in the small hours of the morning or anything of that nature. But here there was a very simple arrangement. Verse 3, two trumpets, when they're both blown, the congregation gathers at the central place of worship. But verse 4, if only one is blown, then the leaders only gather. It was a simple signal. I used to work in an office where the boss wanted to call us. This was in the days before we had various intercom facilities. He had a bell, he used to press one buzzer for this character, two buzzers for Smith, three buzzers for Brown, four buzzers for Jones. And well, this is what's happening here. Two blasts, you all have to come and listen to what the boss is going to say. One blast, it means that Moses is only calling the leaders to give them some instruction. And verse 5, a series of short blasts is called an alarm, and that means the camp is now ready to set out. And so they start moving in the prescribed order. And later on, when they got into their land, you find that these trumpets were blown in times of national crisis, such as wars, or at the times of the national annual festivals, ceremonial blowing of trumpets. Finally, in verse 11, they set out. After 1 year being camped at Sinai, they now set out and head off for Canaan, the land to which they are going as their promised homeland. And my final point concerns another interesting matter of guidance in verse 29. There's a man called Hobab. He's the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. And Moses said to him, look, he said, we're setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. So you come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. But Hobab, he didn't like this idea of traveling. He liked walking around the bush in bare feet and catching goannas or whatever those odd chaps did. And he said to him, he said, look, I don't go. He says, I don't want to depart from my own land or leave my wife and family behind. But Moses prevailed upon him in verse 3, and he says, look, don't leave us. He says, I pray you, because you know how we are to encamp in the wilderness. You know this place like the palm of your hand. We've never been through here before, says Moses, and you can go with us. You can be our eyes for us. And whatever good the Lord does to us, then you'll cash in on the blessing because you'll be with us. And we find, if we read on, that Hobab went with them. I just mention that to anchor us into reality. It's all right to talk about God's will and getting the guidance of the cloud and my conviction that God is doing this. It's good to get that type of guidance, but at the same time, it's a very down-to-earth matter. And here we find that Moses anchors the whole thing in the nitty-gritty of walking through the bush. It's okay to trust in God, but at the same time, we want somebody to be able to help us through, find our way, read the compass or read the sun or however they got through. He knows where the water holes are. He may know certain types of animals and other things that they're going to meet. You see, these people were rather in the dark. They'd never been through this sort of terrain before. That's why God gave them all those laws about animals in Leviticus. An animal that has a parted hoof, or something swims in the water that has fish and scales or doesn't have fish and scales, or if it's an animal that chews the cud or doesn't chew the cud. You can eat some and you can't eat others. Because most of these animals they'd never met before. They lived in Egypt. It's a fairly flat, sandy place, and there was a minimum of animals there. But now they're going to meet all sorts of animals, and God gave them some simple rules of thumb so that they could recognize them easily and say to themselves, oh good, that one's okay, we can eat that one, but this one, never seen him before. Anyway, he's got that sort of foot, so we won't eat him. It was a very simple bit of bushcraft, you might say. Old-fashioned guidance. But it was very helpful. And here again, with this man Hobab to come with them, to look out for them, to be a general watch to... He knew where all the bandits used to hide behind the rocks, the raiding Amalekites. He said they always come around the back of that ridge there, dive down here, and there's another lot of rocks over there, so be careful when you go through there, because that's where they're likely to be hiding. And all this sort of thing, as Moses says, you'll be our eyes for us, because you know all the tricks. And so Hobab went with them. It's a very down-to-earth thing, isn't it? Flashing lights and mystical feelings in the middle of the night, that really isn't the whole story. We need our Hobabs among us. There's a proverb that says, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who listens to counsel is wise. And on that note, we'll finish that study.